For the past two decades, CJSF 90.1 FM has been the game-changing radio station people have tuned in to listen, share, discuss, and celebrate. From authors, actors, and entertainers to journalists, business leaders, and sports figures, CJSF has welcomed esteemed guests giving you the best in music, news, and spoken word, undoubtedly changing the sound of community radio since 2003. CJSF, diverse, independent, yours.
There is going to have to be a really massive uprising in this country against the entire system, because every time we're trying to tinker around the sides, the fact that we don't have a healthcare system in this country is something that is so horrific that I just keep thinking at some point there needs to be a real uprising against this system. When will it happen? I don't know. And so in the meantime, I think, yes, we have to fight for those crumbs, but what we want is the whole pie.
That's Medea Benjamin, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Medea Benjamin on system change. The multiple problems facing the United States can no longer be swept under the rug. Modest so-called reforms are not sufficient given the magnitude of the crises we face, from imperialism and militarism to war and the climate emergency. Our dollar-driven politics is corrupt. We need system change, not cosmetic change. Individually, we can do small things, but connecting with kindred spirits and organizations can make a difference in not only overcoming isolation, but can lead to changes in consciousness and positive initiatives. One such organization is Code Pink. Founded in 2002, it is a women-led grassroots nonprofit working to end U.S. wars, support peace and human rights, and redirect our tax dollars into healthcare, education, green jobs, and other life-affirming programs. Medea Benjamin, a co-founder of Code Pink, is our guest today. She's a renowned peace activist and social justice advocate. Newsday calls her one of America's most committed and most effective fighters for human rights. Author of many books, her latest is War in Ukraine. I talked with her in the studios of KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, in early April. Welcome to the program, Medea.
Great to be with you, David.
Henry Luce, the media mogul, founder of Time, Life, and Fortune, declared in an influential essay in 1941 that the American century was at hand. Well, it looks like that prediction might be coming up short by a couple of decades. Beset with multiple problems, from a shredded safety net to trains literally going off the rails to grotesque inequality to the threat of more pandemics to the existential dangers of climate chaos and terminal war, where does the U.S. stand today with its worldwide archipelago of military bases and a war budget of $1 trillion? And with rising gun violence at home, the inability of the state to protect its own citizens, lots of guns abroad, lots of guns at home. Is there any connection between the two?
It is important to recognize that we have created this country that puts so much of our funds into militarism. It's now almost $1 trillion of our budget. It's more than half of the discretionary funds. It's more money than the federal government puts into things like healthcare and education and housing. And so, of course, we have a system that is reflective of that. You know, you have to look at the budget as a moral document. And there we see what Martin Luther King would have called approaching spiritual death, because we put so much more of our funds into destruction than programs of social uplift. And I think when we talk about the violence abroad and the violence overseas, we have to see that connection, because There are so many ways to make those connections. One is to say that when you glorify violence overseas and you glorify the military and you teach people to go overseas and carry weapons and use those weapons, what do you expect when those people come home? Every time there's a mass shooting in this country, I always wonder, was that somebody in the military? And the majority of cases, it was somebody who is trained to kill, trained to use weapons, oftentimes given preference in our police forces. The level of domestic violence among people who've been in the military is tremendous. And then all of the military surplus, in quotes, that then get put into our police stations. You know that program, David, the one called the 1033 program that takes these Pentagon tanks and grenades and assault weapons and gives them for free to police departments all over this country. And then it's sort of a lose it or use it or lose it situation, and they use them. So these are just some of the connections. But I think in general, if you look at the issue of where we spend our resources, if we're not putting money into helping people live their lives better, we are contributing to a state of where people are doing more acts of violence, of crime, of having a very difficult life that should be made easier by a government that takes care of the needs of its people.
In President Eisenhower's January 17, 1961 farewell address, he warned the country about what he called the military-industrial complex. And this was coming from a five-star general, you know, supreme commander of Allied troops in Europe in World War II. No pacifist, he. Now, Ray McGovern, a former CIA official and now a critic of U.S. foreign policy, has updated Ike's formulation. He's coined the term MICIMAT, that stands for Military Industrial Congressional Intelligence Media Academia Think Tank, MICIMAC. Seymour Melman spoke of the permanent war economy. Now, in a talk you gave in Boulder, organized by the Rocky Mountain Peace Center, you compared military weapons manufacturers to, quote, an octopus with many tentacles. What do you mean by that?
You see their influence in so many different ways. I spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C., and while we're knocking on the doors of our congresspeople begging to have meetings, the lobbyists for the military, well, let's call it the MICIMAT, they are there in full force. There's more lobbyists than there are congresspeople. They don't have to go in the back door. They go in the front door. They go right to the Capitol where they have meetings. These are the companies that are also giving money directly to the campaigns of the congresspeople, which in the eyes of anybody who really looks at this would be a form of bribery, because then these are the very people that allocate the money that goes into this military budget. You have the revolving door where people like the Secretary of Defense come from the board of Raytheon, but you also have more and more people being elected to Congress who come directly from the military. Either they're veterans or they work for some of these companies, and they are people who believe that the military has the answers to most of the problems that we see overseas, even though the U.S. has lost the wars in Vietnam, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, they still are very much committed to so much of our budget going to the military and then advocating for these wars overseas. And then you have the issue of these military companies that have decided that it was in their interest to produce pieces of their weapons in every single congressional district of this country. So as I travel around and I find in very liberal blue districts, the biggest employer often tends to be a company that has some kind of connection to the military. So these are just some of the ways the tentacles are out there. And one more I should say, David, is all of the propaganda that the military produces with our dime billions of dollars that are spent, whether it's in the sports arenas or on holidays or religious settings or all kinds of ways that they enter into our lives, convincing us that they are the greatest military ever and that we should keep handing over so much money to them when they can't pass an audit, when they disappear, so much of our money goes into a black hole that goes into the military. And yet people continue to think that this is an extremely trusted part of our government. And just also, where does all the know-how from that come from? I mean, that's brilliant minds that are working on these things. And you see it in the universities around this country, particularly in the engineering departments, that so many of these departments have connections with the military. They're getting money from the research part of the military called DARPA. And as I travel around the country, I'm meeting with students, and sometimes they are engineering students, and they lament the fact that their education is already mixed up with the military, and that they wonder if they're going to be able to get jobs when they graduate in fields where they're not going to be connected to the military. So also just think of all the brilliant young minds that are put into how do they create better killing machines instead of things like how do we deal with the climate crisis.
The doomsday clock of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists is now at 90 seconds to midnight. It's the closest to global catastrophe it has ever been, a time of unprecedented danger. In a mid-March article, they write, "The United States is in a developing military confrontation with China over Taiwan. Objectively, this prospective confrontation is absurd. China and the U.S. should be focused on improving life for their citizens, not on threatening the future of civilization." There's a lot of saber rattling going on back and forth around the Taiwan Strait and the South China Sea and the U.S.'s projection of force in Northeast Asia. What do you see coming there?
Well, let's remember it's the South China Sea. It's not the South America Sea. You know, why are we provoking so much conflict with a country like China that we need to work with to address the issues like the climate crisis? You know, here we are in the case of Ukraine, involved in a war there that also has a part of it that is a proxy war between the U.S. and Russia. And at the same time, we're already looking towards China. And we have people in our military. We have people in both the Democratic and the Republican members of Congress who are competing with each other to see who can be the toughest on China, taking regular trips to Taiwan, allocating more and more weapons to be sold to Taiwan, and the level of rhetoric about coming war with China is just a horrific thing for the entire planet. And I think we, as this people who live in this country, have to find ways to get to our quote, elected officials to say that these wars are not in our interests, that we have no interest in confronting China, and that while China is making friends around the world by producing things that are useful for people and infrastructure projects and leading the world in production of things like solar panels and windmills and high-speed rail, the United States is still stuck in a war economy. And that if we want to make friends around the world, instead of all the saber rattling, we should be looking to the Chinese as examples of how do we use our economic prowess to be able to make people's lives better around the world instead of using our military might.
The media are often cheerleaders for war. And just to give you one example, you know, the PBS NewsHour, maybe you've seen it, you know, it's a very sober, serious program. There's no yelling. People speak in complete sentences, you know, a very liberal type of discourse. Well, recently, David Brooks, a New York Times columnist who's a regular on the NewsHour, was commenting on the Ukraine war. And he said, "We're spending a few tens of billions of dollars. We've already destroyed half the Russian military. Like, what could be a better investment than that? And then his partner on the program, Jonathan Capehart, who's a Washington Post editor, chimed in, criticizing Governor DeSantis' comment about Ukraine. Capehart said, "There can't be any daylight between America's resolve and America's commitment to Ukraine and defending Ukraine. Democracy must win."
Yeah, where do you go from there? In the war in Ukraine, it seems like the U.S. is more interested now in weakening Russia than they are in supporting Ukraine. If you were really interested in supporting Ukraine, our government would be focusing on how do you get to negotiations as quickly as possible. I don't know if you saw one of our recent Code Pink interventions when Anthony Blinken was speaking in Congress, and I got up and said, you know, the American people don't want to keep funding an unwinnable war that could lead to World War III or a nuclear conflict. If you don't like the Chinese peace plan for Ukraine, where is your peace plan? That's what we have to focus on, not how can we destroy Russia, because, you know, you destroy Russia even if you were successful in doing that. Imagine what would come after. I mean, look at what the U.S. has done in its interventions in trying to overthrow governments in places like Iraq and Libya and Afghanistan. You get something worse than what you came in. You know, while we condemn the Russians for the invasion, what this invasion is doing is giving justification for massive more money for the U.S. to spend on these weapons of mass destruction. And it's also causing Russia and China, that we were just talking about, to spend a lot more money on their military, and the Europeans to spend more money on their military. So anybody who wants to see a demilitarization of the entire world has to work for an end to the conflict in Ukraine. And the only way to end that is through negotiations.
And moving back to China, just to give listeners a sense of where they might be coming from, President Xi criticized Western countries for their, I'm quoting now, all-around containment, encirclement, and suppression of China, led by the United States. He said it has, quote, brought unprecedented severe challenges to our country's development. So they have, a stake in this game, obviously. And, you know, their perspective is that they're being surrounded by U.S. military bases and are being threatened.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I say, you know, it's the South China Sea. Why is the U.S. Navy there? Why is the U.S. military surrounding them? Why are we now putting bases back into the Philippines? Why do we have bases in Japan and South Korea, all over that part of the world? You know, the fact that the U.S. has over 750 military bases around the world makes the U.S. the largest military power around the world, but is really part of the old dinosaur, the way of looking at the world that we can control things by putting our military footprint there. China is certainly threatened by the U.S. presence in the region, is threatened by the war games that the U.S. continues to play out in what would it look like to have a war with China. And this is, in some ways, the death wish of people in this Mickey Mat complex who are really contemplating what it would be like to have a war with China. So let's go back to this whole idea of how do we move our economy from one that is based on a war economy to one that is based on a peace economy? How do we build up a real movement in this country that demands that we stop putting this massive amount of money into having 750 military bases around the world? How do we rein in that military-industrial complex? You know, that's part of what Code Pink has been doing for years and years in programs that we have, like Divest from the War Machine, where we go to cities and push for divestment. We go to universities and push for divestment from the big military contractors. And we also go to members of Congress and we ask them to take a pledge that they won't take money from the five biggest weapons companies. Those are things that we can do on the grassroots level to try to build our way up to having this kind of effective pressure to take money out of the military and put it back into people's needs.
And what are some techniques of getting beyond the choir in this quest to build a movement to roll back militarism and U.S. imperialism? You know, how do you talk to people who are diametrically opposed to everything you stand for?
Well, at this point, it's not even so much diametrically opposed to everything we stand for. It's how do we get people who agree with us on so many issues to recognize that the putting $1 trillion into the military is actually affecting their ability to get a universal health care system, for example, or to get the cancellation of student debt, and we should go further than that, which is free college education for anybody who needs it and wants it. How do we convince people in the environmental movement that they must see the direct connections between militarism and war and destruction of the environment? How do we bring these movements together? And that's something that those of us in the peace movement have been trying to do over the years, and reaching out to these different movements, being allies, coming out for them when they're doing demonstrations, when they have bills in Congress. But it's been, it's effective in some ways. If you look at things like the Poor People's Campaign, which is a group that has recognized since the beginning, taking Martin Luther King's opposition to poverty, militarism, and racism, and adding the issues of the environment into there, that's a movement that integrates a lot of these issues. And we have to do that and build that up across these different sectors. So yes, it would be interesting and important on specific issues like Ukraine to reach out to people who are opposed to us in many other issues, but agree with us that we shouldn't continue the blank check and there should be negotiations. But in the meantime, we have a lot of work to do to build up, even in the progressive movement, the links, the understanding, and get them on board to be pressuring with us at times like this with the Ukraine war, to be getting their members, the massive amounts of people who work in the environmental movement, to understand that they have to join us in calls for peace talks.
In terms of international law and concern for human rights, the U.S. applies it selectively to designated enemy states such as Russia, China, Cuba, Syria, Venezuela, Iran, and North Korea. But U.S. allies such as Israel, India, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, the UAE, they're exempt from any kind of scrutiny. They're given a free pass. No sanctions, no public condemnations. Why?
Because the U.S. is so hypocritical that it applies this issue of human rights and democracy in a kind of weaponized way to divide the world between good and evil. And the good are people who or governments that are allies of the United States, and the evil are ones that want to find a different path. And so within that good, we have the Saudis. Good in the sense that until very recently, they were close allies of the United States, and so the U.S. would supply them with weapons, even though they were using those weapons to bomb the poorest country in the Arab world, which is Yemen. You have the so many examples, as you put out, of the hypocrisy of the United States. And this comes in when we want to condemn Russia for its illegal invasion of Ukraine, for its war crimes that it's committing. And yet so many countries and people around the world say, well, yeah, maybe that's true. But who is the United States to be leading this charge when the U.S. did something similar in its invasions of Iraq, its invasions of Libya, the lack of accountability for U.S. war crimes, the U.S. wanting to pretend that it believes in international law, but it only does it when it's to the U.S. advantage. So it's very hard these days for people around the world to see the U.S. as any kind of leader when it comes to human rights and democracy. When President Biden has these gatherings to bring the democratic countries of the world together, many people around the world just laugh at that and say what it means is the U.S. bringing its allies together, not the democratic world together.
And Washington likes to hide behind this phrase, the rules-based global order. You know, chalk up another one for Orwell with that.
Where the U.S. makes the rules and gives the orders.
Speaking of Orwell in his classic 1946 essay, Politics and the English Language, he wrote, "In our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible." It's a lexical minefield out there. What kind of techniques would you recommend to decode propaganda and to peel away the layers of deceit and distortion that so much of the media are enveloped in?
Well, I guess I would turn that around and ask you, because you're a part of this media and do such a good job by giving people alternatives. And that's what I think we really have to build up at this time, which is tell people to turn off their, tell them to turn on to free speech TV and turn off the mainstream cable news shows, to recognize, especially at a time when we're in this war in Ukraine and we're saber rattling around China, to not believe what they hear in the mainstream media and to seek out these alternatives, to be very careful about what you decide to believe and not, and to really recognize that the terms democracy, the terms of human rights, these issues of defending democracy versus authoritarianism, you know, that they are being weaponized now, and people have to look beyond that and seek alternative sources of information like your program.
And speaking of Saudi Arabia, China recently brokered a deal between Iran and the kingdom. They had broken off diplomatic relations 7 years ago. That was quite an interesting geopolitical development of China inserting itself in the Middle East between these two different countries.
It's absolutely astounding, because China has not been known for playing this kind of role. It's known as this economic powerhouse that is now the number one trading partner with most countries around the world. But it's really not tried to get involved in a lot of these conflicts far from their borders. And so when you see them brokering this extraordinary deal of these two arch enemies that have been at each other's throats, it is something that has made many countries around the world stand up and say, aha, you know, maybe China could play a positive role in trying to mediate some of the global conflicts, because countries around the world have good relationships with China because of the economic developments that China is part of. And that gives China a lot of leverage. When you look at now, for example, with Russia and Ukraine, China has leverage with both countries because it has had strong economic ties with both of those countries. So I think this Saudi-Iran deal is a game changer. And it's a game changer in the Middle East, and it could be a game changer for the role that China might play in the future.
And China's BRI, Belt and Road Initiative, is not just in West Asia, but Latin America, Africa, literally worldwide investment by China.
Absolutely. And then you have the economic entities like the one known as BRICS, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, that is extremely powerful. And now so many other countries want to join in that, and they're having their own bank and their own lending institutions, and more of these economic entities that are starting to get around the dollar are being strengthened, with the U.S. abusing its role as the currency of international finance, abusing its role as using economic sanctions to crush other countries. And now I think the world is shifting tremendously, and we are going to find in the years to come that there are going to be a multipolar world and a world that is not dependent on the dollar.
You're listening to Medea Benjamin on System Change. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. This year marks the 75th anniversary of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, in which Eleanor Roosevelt